Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey.
Quick question for you. What makes you feel more invigorated, less stressed, and more in control of your body? The answer, more energy. Specifically, more quantum energy, because our bodies are quantum systems. Leela Quantum Tech has figured out a way to harness quantum energy so you can reach a state of vibrancy that you've probably never felt. Dozens of studies show that Leela Q's products neutralize the effects of harmful EMFs around us and even release positive energy that can improve your blood flow, optimize your heart rate, and other benefits. Leela Q has some heavy science backing it up. A recent study looked at people who use Leela Q for just 10 minutes. The study used a special blood illumination technique called dark field microscopy, and it showed significant protective and improvement effects on blood flow. So take a quantum leap into higher vibration at LeelaQ.com/Dave and claim your exclusive 10% discount. Everyone's talking about red light therapy beds, and for good reason. There's a company called ARRC LED that's building an entirely new class of LED devices. ARRC LED beds integrate proprietary scanning technology and frequency protocols to shape the delivery of six different wavelengths in dose-optimized photobiomodulation. Yes, that's a lot of words. What it is, though, is that photobiomodulation improves the underlying energetics of the cells in your body. And those changes can benefit nearly every tissue and organ and system in your body. You change your cells and you change your life. For more information, visit ARRCLED.com.
Today's cool fact of the day is about ringing in the ears. If you've ever gone to a loud concert or had exposure to like an airplane engine and your ears are ringing, you've had a symptom of inner ear damage, which is also known as tinnitus. That's the perception of ringing or buzzing or roaring, clicking, whistling, and whatnot when there isn't actually a sound there. The normal explanation for this is that your ears have tiny little hairs called cilia that move based on the different pressures of the sound waves that travel through them. That is something that then triggers your auditory nerve to send a signal to your brain, which then says, hey, I heard something. And it's true. If you damage those hairs, they can get broken and they can send the wrong signals into your brain, which can make the ringing sound. But the other thing that biohackers know can cause a ringing sound is actually jaw tension, believe it or not. If you have excess tension in your jaw that affects your trigeminal nerve, one of the side effects of that is ringing in the ears. So it can happen from the nerves or it can happen from the hairs in your ears. Either one works.
Hey there, ice bath lovers. Do you want to take your cold exposure game up a notch with some contrast therapy? Well, you should, because cold plunges and contrast therapy can lower stress, up your immunity, and even help you sleep better. It works better than just cold therapy alone. Well, now you can do that with the new Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tubs by Master Spas. Whether you want to relax in a hot soak or get energized with a cold plunge, the Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tub has you covered. You can easily hop out of the hot water, get in the cold water, and go back and forth. When you do that, you get better results in less time, and that's what biohacking is all about. Go to chiligoattubs.com, use promo code DAVE500, and you can save $500 on any Chili Goat cold tub. I have one in my backyard. That's chiligoattubs.com, promo code DAVE500.
Today, we have a really good interview with John Kiefer, a software geek turned exercise physiologist. Can you say biohacker? Kiefer, as he goes by, uses his knowledge of systems thinking to improve human performance. Today, we talk about his unique system of nutrient timing called carb backloading. If you're one of those people who wants to gain as much muscle as you can with the minimum amount of fat or just maintain a healthy weight without driving yourself crazy, there are some methods in the show that may very well be right for you.
Now we're going to have our exclusive interview with John Kiefer on carb backloading.
We have John Kiefer, who goes by Kiefer, who's an exercise scientist, a nutrition expert, and author of the new book, Carb Backloading. Kiefer applies his knowledge from a career in physics to hack the human body for fat loss, muscle gain, and improved performance. So you guys can all tell why we would invite Kiefer on the show. He's another biohacker. He writes about his work at dangerouslyhardcore.com. He's the author of The Carb Night Solution and is releasing a new book that's designed for rapid fat loss and muscle gain. Kiefer is coming on Upgraded Self Radio to help you do what some people call alchemy, burning fat and building muscle at the same time. Kiefer, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Appreciate the invite.
Tell us, how did you get interested in diet and health in the first place?
It seems to be a typical story in this industry, but just grew up as a very portly kid. My parents had no idea about nutrition, so it was breakfast cereals, and then that led to me watching TV a lot and eating loaves of bread. My mom actually stopped buying butter because I'd go in and sneak a bite off of a stick of butter in the refrigerator whenever I had the opportunity. So I just didn't have the best eating habits. You know, I started off in private school and everybody knew each other. It wasn't a big deal. I was just chubby and didn't understand what that was until I went to public school. And my first year there, I was maybe in public school a month. Classroom was real quiet. And this one student, basketball player, just stands up, points at me and says, "You're fat." And the whole class started laughing. And that was the first time I realized I was the fat kid. And so that just kind of embarrassment and heckling, I decided that I didn't want to be the fat kid anymore. So I, you know, about 13 is when I just became really aware and started, probably had a few bad dieting habits, and none of that was working. So it just, you know, always being curious about everything, it just led me to read and, you know, try to figure out different things to do.
So it sounds like a familiar story. You know, being the fat kid myself, I hit 300 pounds by the time I was done with college, but I was pretty big growing up. It's amazing. Kids, teenagers will do same things that adults will do to try and lose weight because, you know, nobody likes it. And it's not a lack of willpower. It's lack of good advice from where I've arrived. It's actually kind of painless to lose weight if you just actually have the truth. So I'm really hoping that you can help share some of what you've learned to deal with the problem on the show. Let's start by, what is carb backloading, the big topic of your new book? And you kind of mentioned how you thought of it, but give us more details about the background and just tell us what it is and why it matters.
Well, it's actually very simple. Most people do the opposite of what it takes to lose weight. They eat carbohydrates in the morning because the body's more sensitive to insulin. So the logic is that if you're eating carbohydrates when your body's sensitive to insulin, it can use them better. Well, insulin's not really there to help you use the carbs. It's there to help your body store them. And, you know, in certain performance instances, it will help you use them. For example, long aerobic events, endurance events. I remember when I used to cycle, you know, go on 100-mile rides, I was definitely consuming carbohydrates during those rides, and they allowed me to finish them in pretty good times. But for most people who are sedentary, that's the absolute wrong thing to do. So then, of course, later in the evening, you're carb insensitive, which is when they tell you not to eat carbs because they build up in the bloodstream, and not all your tissues can use them efficiently, and they can basically kind of burn out your nervous system a little bit. But if you train in the afternoon, you can actually cause your muscle tissue to continue using sugar while stopping your fat cells from being able to store it. So insulin becomes a different player in the evening if you can train at the right time. So carb backloading is simply, you don't eat carbs during the first half of the day. You basically ignore all the health experts out there. And then at night, after you train, you can eat a lot of carbs and not gain body fat, actually gain muscle mass and lose body fat. So that's the gist of carb backloading. And it's important because it just makes dieting stupid simple. I mean, I've had people comment, you know, I don't think I understand anything about what Kiefer's saying, but I've already lost 15 pounds and 5 inches on my waist. You know, it just makes the whole process that simple by a relatively small change.
So I really like that because I have also experimented with carb timing, and people who are doing a bulletproof fast will have no carbs in the morning. And I've noticed that I can have very significant amounts of carbs at night, like, you know, bucketfuls of rice if I want to, and I just keep on with the muscle, keep on with you know, not gaining fat from it, versus having it in the morning where there is a difference. What about, though, I mean, if you're eating carbs, doesn't that affect things like ketosis, you know, the fat burning mode that we're in to help us burn fat?
Well, yes, you know, in the evening, you're going to obviously limit your ability to go into ketosis, but ketosis is not a major player in fat burning. At any one time, I can't remember the exact statistics, but ketones for an entire day, let's say you were able to stay ketotic through the entire day, never account for more than, I think it's 4 or 5% of energy needs. So they're not a huge player in burning fat. You can burn ample amounts of fat just through the fatty acid cycle and using fatty acids. You don't need a large buildup of ketones to burn body fat. So in the evening, you actually still have accelerated fat burning from the window that's the metabolic window that's created from your resistance training.
So do you only do this on days when you're resistance training?
Not necessarily, no. This question brings up a great point. It's hard for me to ever give concrete answers because, you know, as you know, so much of how your body reacts to food is dependent on everything from what you ate earlier that day to what you literally ate the day before to your stress levels that day. So it's always really hard for me to give, especially when people ask me what I do, it's hard for me to give any kind of concrete answer.
Plus, let's face it, your background is in physics. I mean, quantum theory, I mean, the answer is always it depends, right? I'm with you there. And when I coach people, there's always 10 questions you ask someone before you give them the definitive answer. So I'm completely understanding what you're saying there. Then what makes carb backloading different from what people already do after they work out? I mean, aren't you supposed to have carbs after you work out anyway?
Yeah, a part of it is you're trying to use the day to enhance what those carbohydrates do. So normally when you eat carbohydrates immediately after training, you're getting an insulin spike, which is important for growth. But you're also replenishing glycogen stores. The problem is that window normally only lasts, you're replenishing glycogen stores, only lasts a couple hours. And then after that, depending on the time of day, the carbohydrates may or may not be burned off through wasteful thermogenic processes. And that's one thing that carb backloading, it forces you to eat them in the part of the day when your body is far less efficient at storing them. It will throw off a lot more heat than normal. So that effect in itself helps prevent a lot of fat storage.
Okay, that makes sense.
Definitely, and I think that's a big misunderstanding in the industry, is that you need carbs to fuel the workout. It turns out if you go the majority of the day, or well, the first half of the day without carbohydrates, and your body has no problem maintaining blood sugar levels, at least what it needs. And then B, your body actually responds quicker to exercise as far as the sympathetic nervous system. You release adrenaline faster. Your body is more sensitive, particularly to the fat-burning properties of adrenaline, and you get bigger rushes of adrenaline. So there's three very large positive fat-burning effects that you get just by not eating carbs before you work out and training a little later in the day.
So you're saying there are no benefits from eating carbs before you work out?
Correct.
Excellent. All right. That's a definitive statement, and I could not agree more with it. By the way, it drives me nuts when people go out, you know, have a banana for energy before they go lift weights. It's like, what are you doing? You're not helping yourself in any way, in any way, shape, or form. And, like, don't waste your time because you could be doing something more important. I love that. All right. We totally are in great alignment on that.
Speaking of that, what kind of carbs do you use for carb backloading, or what kind of foods in general?
That really depends. I have a hard time denying my fat kid nature, so often for carb backloading, I'll go towards cherry turnovers every once in a while. Well, no, more than once in a while. Donuts sometimes. It varies. Cookies are always a good one for me. And then I'll have those days where I just, obviously I don't feel like eating crap all the time. And I'll eat a little cleaner, cleaner French fries. Sometimes my favorite's baked sweet potato with coconut oil and cinnamon all mixed together. It's still kind of that sweet candy taste, but it's one of the best combinations that I found for people on carb backloading. The MCTs from the coconut oil help to sustain fat burning. You get a nice insulin release from the sweet potato, and you also get excellent carb storage from it.
It's kind of funny. I've gone through and done a huge amount of research for the Bulletproof Diet around anti-nutrients and toxins and kind of the statistical occurrence of them in foods, and looked for the sources of carbs that have the least toxins that basically make your body go in the opposite direction of what you want. And one of my top three choices would be sweet potatoes or yams. And we eat quite a lot of those. I mean, you can turn them into French fries without actually frying them and damaging the oils. But yeah, it's one of the top carbs, I'd say. But in terms of stuff like, cookies and, other things like that, it sounds like you're pretty much not too worried about the negative effects of gluten and all that other stuff on physiology, because you're just looking for the muscle gain versus like mental performance or something. Like, some of those foods you're eating sound like they might kind of clog things up.
Yeah, it's funny. I actually pick them a little bit according to how much gluten I do. I'm sure you know the statistics, like 50% of people have some sort of allergic reaction to gluten, whether it's an extreme response or just, some intestinal inflammation. And pastries like cherry turnovers, the real flaky doughs, and cookies, that flour is more gluten depleted.
Yes.
As opposed to, breads or, I don't eat donuts very often. Every once in a while I have a craving, but I try to go for those lower gluten things because my body reacts so much. That's one thing I love about all this is I know exactly when I screwed up. I know when I ate something that claimed to be something that it's not, because I can read all the signs that my body gives now. And at first I didn't understand why cherry turnovers. I mention them a lot because they're just kind of my go-to. They're really simple. They're easy to find. If I don't have time to prepare what it is I would really want, then they're easy for me. And I didn't understand it until I started looking at the gluten, and I didn't know that pastry flour was gluten depleted. I was totally clueless.
It's also not just that. It's because when you're eating a pastry like that, they're not using yeast the same way. And the amount of yeast and the type of yeast matters dramatically for what kind of response you get from things like that. For instance, if you were to go to Europe, the next time you're there, try having any of the pastries that you'll find in France, and you'll probably find, since you're in tune with your metabolic responses, you can feel them the same way I can, you'll find that there's a very big difference based on what happens with flour and yeast from Europe versus from the U.S. And it's amazing how detailed our bodies are in understanding this stuff. But I don't know, I would tell people, if you're trying to lose fat, probably any form of turnover with wheat in it is probably not your best bet, but you can do some pretty darn good ice cream that'll still work.
Yeah. There you go. I just had this conversation the other day because that was the first carb backloading food was ice cream.
There are definitely worse things in life. We were actually just posting a recipe, I think this week, for ice cream that actually turns up your hormone response to the point that it's called Get Some Ice Cream. And we're talking about ice cream as well as the metabolic effects of having higher hormone levels an hour after you eat it. But it's amazing. You can use it with real sugar. You can use it with other carb forms in it. And you eat that at night, you feel good and you perform better and you lose weight, which sounds like your program is predicting, getting some sugar later in the evening.
I'm going to have to look up that recipe.
Oh, we'll definitely share it with you. I think it's going out this week. Now, here's another question for you. What about supplements? I mean, you're a guy who's willing to eat cherry turnovers. By the way, I'm jealous. I love cherry turnovers, but they don't love me. So, like, what supplements do you use to take care of yourself? Which ones are a waste of money? Which ones are really good? Like, what's your take on those?
The two main ones that I always take, and I always try to convince other people to take, are fish oils, which, again, that's a mixed bag to find good brands that are high quality, high concentration, and then a good source of whey isolate. Those two, in my opinion, are indispensable, especially with the food environment that we live in today. And then, you know, I don't really subscribe to much else. Caffeine, I consider caffeine a supplement, even though some people consider it, you know, almost lifeblood. And that's about it. You know, creatine, because it does have a lot of scientific backing, and not so much for muscle size or strength gains, but they're starting to find that it can limit the activation of myostatin, which is always myostatin is the, you know, main regulator of one of the main regulators of muscle growth. If you produce too much or it's overactive, your muscles just won't grow. And creatine seems to block some of those effects.
There's also that side benefit. If you're over 30, that it actually raises your IQ in many cases, sometimes very substantially, like 10-point kind of things. So there's all sorts of mitochondrial reasons that you might look at creatine anyway. So that's a good one. You mentioned whey isolate here. So I've done enormous, like, personal testing and research on whey protein over the years. And I used to recommend in version 1.0 of the Bulletproof Diet, I recommended isolate because it didn't have casein in it and because people could tolerate it more. But I found just from talking to people that isolate causes a lot more GI upset. And I found that low temperature processed concentrate is way, way more comfortable for almost everyone to eat. And I'm launching upgraded whey, which has, like, I basically added a whole bunch more IgG to it than you can find it any other way. Much of that in another 30 to 60 days, depending on a bunch of stuff. So, and I actually, Dr. Mercola and I went kind of back and forth on that a little bit. And before he sort of copied my diet and put it on his site, he did make a pretty clear case that he should put, that concentrate ought to be up there higher than isolate in terms of benefits. Why do you recommend isolate?
That's interesting. Mostly because a lot of the research I found that I'm basing that recommendation of is because of the antioxidant properties that whey isolate can fuel.
Glutathione, you're saying.
Exactly. Skyrockets levels of glutathione in the body. And, you know, there's tons of research both at the cellular level and macroscopically that show that it really helps decrease antioxidant effects, free radicals, stops the damaging process. And
yes.
I found that I always had a major problem with – I actually stopped supplementing with protein powders for a while because I was – a few years ago after I had a software job that was horrible, took me out of the gym for 6 months, working 90 hours a week. And when I came back, I was trying to get some of my size back quickly, and I was using just over-the-counter whey isolates, and I noticed that I had a lot of intestinal problems. So I just stopped, and I wasn't sure what it was, and I started to use U.S.-sourced whey isolate that was supposed to be higher quality. You know, what I found was when I did that, I didn't have any of the intestinal. I didn't have the gas or the bloating. I definitely was not bombing the room like I used to. You know, people just could not spend evenings with me because the gas was horrid. And when I made that switch, that all went away. So my thought was that it was the quality of what I was getting at the store and not the whey isolate itself. But I didn't look deeply into that. So I'm curious.
Well,
is that
excellent.
What you found or –
Yeah, I found a lot of people had the GI problems from isolate, and including the protein farts, which are well known by heavy weightlifter types. And I can tell you that those really don't go well with my, you know, vice president at a at a big software internet security company. So I actually do my upgraded whey protein every day with none of those problems, and I'm getting the glutathione effects and the protection effects. Mm-hmm. So what we'll do is when we come out with this stuff, I mean, it's already created. It's just a matter of getting all our labeling and stuff correct. I would love to send you some and just, you know, see how you tolerate it. I think you may be surprised. I certainly was. It's all grass-fed, you know, from grass-fed cows from South America, mm-hmm. low temperature, all that kind of stuff. And I realized I had to be as precise with my whey protein as I did with my coffee if I wanted to just, like, feel good all the time without these weird things happening. But mm-hmm. I don't want to turn this into a whey protein thing because we're here really to focus on your carb backloading. And I know you're interested a lot in GLUT or GLUT activation. Can you tell our listeners about GLUT activation?
Yes. There's a big misconception with insulin, and I don't know if your audience has that necessarily, but the thought is you eat carbs, the insulin rushes out from your pancreas, and that actually pushes or is the carrier for glucose into cells, which isn't really how it works. Your cells have these specialized protein structures called glucose transporters, or GLUTs, and some of them are always present at the cell surface and in body tissue that always has those kind of sticking out into the fluids. They can just grab sugar and bring them right into the cell. You know, they don't need insulin. So, for example, your brain, your liver, your kidneys, they all have they express GLUT 1 and 2 primarily, or 2 and 3. Always the first three all kind of act the same. I believe all cells have GLUT 1, so all cells can use glucose to some degree. 2 and 3 bind more strongly and can help nervous tissue and that tissue fuel itself without insulin. And then muscle tissue and fat tissue has a different kind of GLUT, GLUT 4, and also an isoform GLUT 12, that the cell needs to come in contact with insulin before those GLUT proteins will come to the surface of the cell. So normally they're tucked inside and they never come in contact with glucose, so they can't bring it into the cell. But once they get hit with insulin, they translocate to the surface where they can then start grabbing grabbing glucose and bringing it into the cell. And GLUT 4, 12, and actually 5 are the primary GLUTs in skeletal muscle tissue and fat tissue. So again, and those are our most insulin-sensitive tissues in the body.
So, Kiefer, what it sounds like you're saying is that insulin signals GLUT activation, but the insulin itself is not actually pulling glucose into the cell.
That's correct. The insulin's somewhat like the primer. It just, once cells come in contact with it, the GLUT can raise to the surface, they can grab the sugar and then use it. Without that, the GLUT stays tucked within the surface of the cell, and they can't use a lot of, well, at least skeletal muscle and fat tissue can't use or store a lot of sugar, and that's where diabetics come into, or type 2 diabetics have issues, well, in type 1. The insulin's not present or not causing a reaction to allow those GLUTs to translocate. And if they can't translocate, then the main tissue in your body that normally disposes of glucose can't. And then when that happens, other tissues have to compensate. For example, your kidneys, they become overstressed trying to process all the glucose. Of course, kidney damage is very familiar in diabetic research. And your liver tries as best it can to convert it into glycogen, and then your nervous system tissue is trying to overprocess as well, which, again, causes some of the neuropathy effects that are associated with diabetes.
So I know you're a big fan of resistance training, and you talk a lot in your writing in that carb backloading promo book that I thought was excellent, and I hope all of our listeners read. But you talk about how resistance training is superior to aerobic training for activating these glucose transporters. Why is that, and do you think aerobic exercise can get the same benefit that resistance training can when paired with carb backloading?
Some why questions I can't answer. For example, why resistance training is superior. What is known is that heavy contractions of muscle tissue translocate glute far more extensively than aerobic exercise. So it's the intensity of the contraction that both increases concentration of glute and increases the amount that translocates without insulin. So that's what makes carb backloading, that's what makes resistance training so critical to carb backloading, is that when you contract the muscle under load, it actually causes these glute 4 and glute 12 to translocate without insulin. So even without insulin around, all of a sudden your muscle cells can start using and soak up glucose. Unlike the fat cells, that does not happen when you resistance train. Aerobic training, unfortunately, it does cause some translocation, but not extensive, and can actually blunt the response of later resistance training to GLUT4 translocation. So you could, and I only know this because of certain studies I'll talk about here in a second, but you could make aerobic training work with carb backloading, but it wouldn't be as critical of a component. For example, they did a study last year that I found very interesting that kind of supports the entire carb backloading regime, and that they just took normal sedentary people. They didn't have them exercise at all in any way or deviate from their lifestyle, and all they did was they moved all their carbohydrates from the first half of the day, and then allowed them to eat carbohydrates towards the end of the day. And this was a calorically deficit diet, so they were trying to help these people lose weight. And the people that just ate carbs later in the day actually were able to lose more body fat and keep more muscle without resistance training. So there is just general support, and that's why I say you could make aerobic training work with it, but aerobic training would ultimately decrease the benefit, according to how the effects that it causes, the long-term effects that it causes to cellular metabolism.
That is actually incredibly detailed information, and I'm really stoked that our listeners are going to be able to pick up on those differences. I can tell you the first time I wrote the words aerobic sucks was in about 1998 when I put up my first like anti-aging website where I'm like, just look at the difference in what it does for you cognitively and everything else. That said, Bill Anders made a pretty convincing case for some aerobics helping with telomerase and the length of your telomeres. So there may be some anti-aging benefits there, but if you want to like look good and you want muscles and you don't want to be fat, aerobics is probably the worst form of exercise from my perspective, and it sounds like you're along the same lines.
Yes. There are, however, ways to do your aerobic exercise and get all the benefits. Like, for example, they've been able to correlate cognitive function with age with aerobic health. We can get all those benefits using HIIT, which is high intensity interval training.
Yep.
Yeah, and I mean your workload over, you only need 30 minutes three times a week, and your actual the amount of time that you have high output during that is 3 minutes total, and the rest of the time you're just kind of walking or pedaling. You just need to sprint every 30 seconds out of 4 minutes for all the health benefits without any of the downside. And I would much rather do that than waste my entire day on a bicycle.
I always feel bad when I see sort of like the stereotypical, you know, people out on their lunch hour going for an hour-long waddle. Obviously, they don't have a problem with motivation. They're out doing it. They're just doing something that doesn't work, and that's kind of a crime. But so speaking of that, lunch is not a good time for most people to train. A lot of people train in the morning. How would you do carb backloading if you're not an afternoon trainer, if you do it in the morning? What's up with your ideas there?
You still get a lot of the positive benefits that allow it to work. You get increased glute number, increased glute activation in muscle cells. Muscles become more sensitive to insulin. But you can also kind of mimic what goes on during the day with caffeine. Caffeine has this excellent benefit that is usually seen as something heinous, but caffeine decreases insulin sensitivity. So that means your fat cells and your muscle tissue, when bathed with caffeine, glutes don't translocate like they normally do when insulin's introduced. They actually stay tucked within the cells to a far greater extent. Well, so you can mimic the daily circadian rhythm by having your caffeine right before you work out first thing in the morning. So you have your load of caffeine, you train, and then you can actually have a small load of carbs. You don't want to have a massive amount because you unfortunately will go right back into an insulin-sensitive state within a couple hours. But have a small bit of carbs if your main focus is gaining muscle mass. And then later in the evening, you basically get to eat the same. You get to have some carbs. The real difference is that the carbs you eat in the evening when resistance training, the amount depends on your training intensity, obviously. But they're also more to fuel your workout for the next day. They're not just recovery from training. So it kind of changes this idea of what's your off day when backloading. So normally an off day, if you're training in the afternoon, is you just didn't train that afternoon. If you're training in the morning, an off day from carb backloading is when you don't train the next morning. So even if you didn't train that day, but you're going to train the following morning, those are the days you backload.
Okay, so timing matters, and I'm guessing in your book you have the full sort of instructions for that. Now, I'm going to challenge you a little bit on the use of caffeine there.
Okay.
And are you familiar with mTOR and what it does?
I am. Mammalian target of rapamycin.
Exactly. So one of the things that people who are doing bulletproof fast, like I went 2 years with no exercise and 5 hours or less of sleep per night and actually gained muscle and like got leaner because I was essentially mTOR stacking, which is one of the posts that we're writing up right now. And caffeine actually works with mTOR to help you with muscle gain. But if you use caffeine after workout, it doesn't have the same effect as it does if you use it before. If you have your espresso, then you work out, you get muscle growth. If you work out, then you have caffeine afterwards, it doesn't do the same thing. It actually decreases muscle growth.
That's interesting.
Have you come across that? I've got a link. Dr. Ori, someone. I've got a link on one of my posts about it, but it sounds like something we should take offline because I'm really interested in what you're saying, and I don't know whether glutes or mTOR is a more powerful effect, but for people listening, it's pretty clear that caffeine and by association bulletproof coffee are going to have an effect on your exercise and fat loss no matter what you do, and certainly from a cognitive performance perspective, anyone who's tried bulletproof coffee with grass fed butter in it knows exactly what that does.
Because a lot of the caffeine loading recommendations that I make are pre-training. But I do recommend caffeine post because of the glycogen resynthesis enhancement that it has. And I'm just really curious to see that research because that's also why I recommend – that's another supplement I forgot to mention just because it's kind of newer in my little bag of tricks is leucine. I try to have everybody take – supplement with leucine for that reason. Leucine is one of the few nutrient activators of the mTOR pathway, and it turns out glucose is another. That's why studies show that glucose can enhance muscle growth, can potentiate it, but can't cause it. Leucine acts the same way without ingesting glucose. It can potentiate and activate that mTOR pathway, but leucine alone won't cause muscle growth. So I'm really curious to see to learn about that and know what the interference effects are, because that would definitely modify some of my recommendations.
Killer. I'll send you some of the research, and I love having conversations. I hope everyone listening to this enjoys this sort of thing. But bottom line is we're dialing in here on exact recommendations based on observations of people, based on research, and trying to prioritize something, and you don't have to get it perfect. If you make a decision that says, do I have a good cup of coffee or not a good cup of coffee today with my exercise, you're probably going to have benefits. And the question whether you have it before or after might give you 10% more or less benefits. But we're hopefully steering people who are listening in the right direction to get the benefits and the outcomes that they're looking for. Perfection is not a requirement. It's just a goal.
Right. Yeah. The real goal is getting maximum benefit with minimum effort. So, and you don't always have to be perfect for that.
So speaking of early morning nutrition, how can eating breakfast make it harder to lose fat? So like, why should people avoid eating carbs in the morning and maybe even avoid overall nutrition in the morning?
Waking up in the morning is one of the best things as far as fat burning is concerned that you can possibly do, and everybody has to do it every day. And of course, I'm assuming non-stress or non-extreme stress and somewhat normal sleep cycle. But when you wake up first thing in the morning, your body is primed to mobilize and burn body fat. And that's assuming you don't introduce anything to screw that up, which is food. Cortisol levels are elevated. They elevate naturally all through the evening, and they're highest when you first wake up. And most people think of cortisol as muscle destroyer, life destroyer, skin destroyer, you name it. But when it's able to do its thing naturally, it's actually just a catabolic hormone. That's it. It breaks tissue down into something simpler for fuel. That's all cortisol does. If left on its own, its preference is to break down body fat, not muscle tissue. It only starts to activate the breakdown of muscle tissue when insulin is present at the same time. Insulin's kind of like this grand coordinator that can change aspects of so many different hormones and protein signalers in the body. So if you keep insulin out of the picture and you don't introduce much food, your body doesn't have a lot of choice and prefers to go to its body fat stores. And there's also other effects. For example, the cortisol enhances ghrelin release. And somebody challenged me on the pronunciation of that. So, Dave, do you know, is that correct? Ghrelin, the hunger hormone produced by the gut?
I've heard it called ghrelin, but I couldn't tell you for sure exactly what it is. I don't actually know that even people who are using it regularly in universities all say it the same way.
Right, okay. Yeah, somebody tried to convince me it was ghrelin. But anyway, that's a side note. I have never heard that before.
Sounds like the name of a gangster rapper to me, but hey.
Right. Yeah, so ghrelin spikes shortly after you get up as well. And then that, in turn, there's some controversy whether it actually causes the growth hormone release that follows about an hour to 2 hours after you wake. But again, that growth hormone response is blunted if you eat carbs. So, and of course, growth hormone can help repair body tissue and also break down fat from fat cells and all that good stuff. So that's how you can burn more body fat, by not eating first thing in the morning. And I guess the why of it as well. So, and carbs really screw that up. Small amounts of fat and even smaller amounts of protein don't have as great of an effect. But if you're introducing – it also depends on the fat. Too much quick-acting fat, of which there are not very many varieties, basically medium-chain triglycerides. Those can screw up the process if you have a lot. Regular fats like animal fats, most of the oils, they can take anywhere from 2 to 5 hours to get into your system. So you're not actually introducing an exogenous fuel to the system that's going to screw it up. So that's how avoiding breakfast can help you burn fat.
That makes great sense. So if we're already talking about avoiding breakfast, I mean, isn't essentially, are we getting to the areas of intermittent fasting, which is a quasi part of bulletproof fasting? Is carb backloading something you use with intermittent fasting or not?
It's not, other than some people relate it because I recommend strongly skipping breakfast. But in general, if you look at the studies, particularly over long durations, say three days to a week, all the hormonal effects that happen from fasting are exactly paralleled by just not eating carbohydrates. So, for example, carb night, my first diet that's really just for shredding body fat, it hormonally is almost identical to intermittent fasting. And that's one reason when you eat the carbohydrates once a week, your body's just in this incredibly wasteful state and burns most of it off as heat, but re-energizes hormone levels. So you could think of intermittent fasting as, well, you could actually think of carb backloading or carb night necessarily as intermittent fasting evolved. I think that's what I call it in my carb backloading book, because you can get all the same effects and you can get greater muscle retention and growth by continuing to eat, just not eating any carbohydrates whatsoever. Go ahead. I heard a sigh.
Hallelujah is all I can say there. Yes. So I didn't mean to be sighing there. I think the microphone's a little close. But seriously, that's using those kinds of techniques, specifically with not really doing a fast, but including a lot of fat in the morning using Bulletproof coffee. My sort of fastest success story now has been 75 pounds of fat loss in 75 days without any significant amounts of exercise, just completely dropping fat by stacking mTOR and doing what you're talking about here, the same sort of plan. And it's so obvious that there's no excuse for people walking around with 100 extra pounds of fat. It's just because they don't know that they could do this. I mean, 2 months of slight discomfort without a decline in cognitive function, if you do this right, you don't get cold and feel crappy like you do when you cut calories. I mean, I don't know why everyone isn't walking around looking good, because it's not that hard.
That's the hardest message to get to people, because everybody, once you learn these things, it makes life so easy. People look at me all the time like I'm one of those just special genetically gifted people because of the things I'll buy in the grocery store or what they'll see me eat. And like, it's not that. This is what I'm doing. This is why I'm doing it. And it makes it easy. And they just cannot fathom that it could actually be easy. They just can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a shame. And it was interesting, the comment you made earlier in the conversation about your body is very finely tuned to all these little differences, like the type of yeast used in the baked goods and the type of flour. But it's so, I would say, intelligent. They've done recent studies that I just thought were amazing. They took two meals. They were identical macronutrient breakdown. There was no difference in protein, fat, or carbohydrate levels in the two meals. They were basically a burger. One burger was pure fast food processing, so everything was incredibly processed. The meat started off as a paste that they later form and add beef flavoring to, all that kind of stuff. And the other meal was grass-fed beef. You know, the materials had the least amount of processing possible. And the body had completely different hormonal responses to those two meals. Even though all the macronutrients were identical, the body instantly knew the difference in the two. And it amazes me that with information like that and nutrient timing and everything else that we've been learning over the last 20 years, people still just think it's carbs, fat, protein. That's all you need to worry about. And I think those are the kind of things that make it difficult. People don't think of the body as having some sort of intelligence as to what environment it's in based on the food that you give it.
I always try to explain to people that if it was just about carbs, fat, and protein, that you could have a bowl of black widow venom, which is a protein, and hey, you've got your protein for the day. And if they look at you like, well, that'd be stupid, but okay, protein, soy protein, whey isolate, whey concentrate, all those things, it actually matters. So it's if it was only that simple, we could just shovel whatever in our bodies, but unfortunately, we're not all robots, because if we were all robots, then we could just fuel ourselves like robots, but we're biological entities, and what you eat matters.
Yes, I completely agree. Completely.
So then let's talk about, in practical terms, what a typical carb backloading training day looks like for you. Like, what's the most crap you've been able to eat and stay lean and maybe still gain muscle? Like just what do you do on a typical backloading day? Walk people through it, because a lot of people listening to this are going to go out and buy an armload of cherry turnovers, despite my recommendations for sweet potatoes as well as yours, and they're going to try this. So how do you do it on an average day?
Average day, wake up about 6 or 7 in the morning. I'll have some coffee, and that's about it. Most days, especially now because I'm so busy, I probably won't eat until 11 or 12, and that meal will be a beef patty on a salad. Usually it's around a pound of beef, and it's on a salad, and I'll sometimes throw a fried egg on top, maybe a little cheese, not much. And then in the salad, it's not just lettuce. I throw in a bunch of vegetables just because, A, it helps with the digestion of the beef mostly, and it's another thing, the more fiber you get in, the less usable calories you get from that meal. So it's a way for me to feel satiated, get in nutrients I need, and also keep my caloric load kind of under control. And then the next hour I might snack on some cheese and beef, cheese and turkey, something like that. I try not to do shakes in the first half of my day anymore. Because if I do, I completely get burned out on them. And then that's about it. Cottage cheese is another one of my favorites, low fat, 2%. I'll have like a pound of cottage cheese sometimes in there. And then I'll train. I try not to eat anything 2 hours before training. I'll train. I usually don't have anything beforehand except maybe some coffee or some sort of caffeine. And then after training, immediately post-training, I usually have some extremely ripe bananas. And I've got a protein formula, and I call it a hypertrophic accelerator. It's a mixture of whey isolate, hydrolysates, both casein and whey hydrolysates, and leucine, and also micellar casein. And then about 30 minutes after that, when my training is spot on, it might be literally, and I know this goes against the gluten thing, I might eat an entire pizza, and then later that night have 3 or 4 turnovers. And then also, you know, if I'm eating primarily carbs like that, then I'll include shakes in the later part of the night to make sure I get in the ample fuel to help my muscles grow. So I'll have whey isolate shakes or casein-based shakes. Or a lot of times, I like cottage cheese so much, I'll eat a pound of cottage cheese and then I'll eat the turnovers. So the most I've been able to backload and stay lean, I would say I went through this just horrible stint where I was eating out a lot, and I was going to the Cheesecake Factory, I think, every night. And there it's easy to have meals of 4,000 and 5,000 calories without a problem. And then I would still eat more later in the evening. And that went on for about 2 weeks, and I really noticed no detrimental effects whatsoever.
What are the most common mistakes you see people making when they try to do carb backloading? It seems like pretty simple to me, but, you know, I'm sure there are some things you've heard where people have done some stuff that's a little bit silly that messed up their progress.
There's two things that stick out. One is they completely ignore other facets of nutrition. So when they get done working out, all they're thinking about are carbs, and they're trying to eat tubes of cookie dough. They're trying to eat pizza. It's amazing the things people try to stuff into themselves. And I'm not sure where that came from. There's no sense of adequate food needs. And of course the Cheesecake Factory example is bad in my case, but you know, I carry probably on average about 80 pounds more muscle than most people. So I can get away with that for a little bit longer. Most people can't. But they just focus on all the crap. They don't care about protein. They don't care about quality, and they do that for months. You know, that I enjoyed the food at the Cheesecake Factory, but I didn't enjoy having to eat that way for that long. Eventually it takes its toll. You just don't feel as good. And so people always make that mistake. They just want to gorge. And then the other is the complete opposite extreme. They don't want to eat anything that they might see in any way as bad, even ripe bananas, because they've got this idea that high glycemic foods are bad and there's all these bad recommendations. I feel almost responsible because I introduced the glute conversation into the bodybuilding world when people didn't understand it, but they grabbed onto it and wanted to create their own versions. Like, oh, because of glute, you should eat low glycemic carbs all the time after training, which is the complete opposite of what you need. You need those quick spiking carbohydrates. You don't necessarily need a dump truck full, but but you want to avoid the low glycemic foods. So people who fail even worse are those who want to stay quote unquote healthy. So they're eating brown rice, they're eating whole grain breads. They're really scared to eat anything that might spike insulin levels. And you pretty much destroy the effect of carb backloading because you're creating this long insulin window that lasts far longer than it needs to. Your glucose levels are elevated far longer than they're needed and on into the night, which then also interrupts how your hormones react as you sleep. So your growth hormone has a very long delayed response. Growth hormone won't even rise in the middle of the night. It goes through periodic peaks and valleys, but that first peak won't occur until about 2 hours after insulin levels have fallen to very low levels. So if you're eating low glycemic carbs, particularly before bed, you're extending the amount of time without those beneficial hormones off into the night. And cortisol will raise regardless. So now you've got an even worse situation because cortisol levels elevated with insulin levels at the same time, again, cause the growth of fat cells, and not just existing fat cells, but can actually help stimulate satellite cells to grow into healthy adult adipose cells so you can get even fatter. So those are the two most common mistakes, the two extremes.
That is extremely useful info for people who are listening, and I agree with what you're saying. I think that's awesome. Now, you mentioned two mistakes, and we close all of our interviews now with a request for your top three recommendations to help people perform better across every domain, like basically three sentences, not like, you know, a paragraph on each one. Number one, number two, and number three that you can do to just kick more ass. What are your one, two, and three recommendations?
Number one's resistance train. Number two is skip breakfast. And number three would be to use caffeine appropriately.
Love it. Now, tell us, where can people learn more about you? Give us your URL and how people can get with you on Facebook and Twitter, etc.
My main site is called dangerouslyhardcore.com, and it's all spelled out, one word, well, one group. And from there, you can find me on Facebook. There's a contact form where people can get in touch with me. And I recently opened up forums to help people get answers to their questions from other members. There's a lot of people that have been doing this for over a year now. They have a lot of experience, and so they get to help each other as well. But my main site's dangerouslyhardcore.com. And from there, you can ask questions, you can get answers, and you can read great material.
Thank you so much for being on the show today, Kiefer, and I look forward to having you on again.
All right, I look forward to having a conversation again.
Thanks. Bye.
If you're looking for a way to know which foods are making you weak, check out the free app that we just released called Bulletproof Food Sense. It works by using the phone camera in order to get a measurement of your heart rate, or you can just type in your heart rate if you know what it is from some other monitoring device. You do this before a meal and you do it after a meal a couple times. And based on changes in your heart rate, the application can help you to identify which foods are causing an immune response in your body. Based on that, you can choose to avoid those foods and you'll find a huge boost in your performance just from not eating the foods that you have sensitivities to. You'll also find that you can lose weight much more easily when you're not eating foods that cause you to feel foggy and inflamed all the time. This app is free. It's called Bulletproof Food Sense, and it's available on the iPhone store. You can also take a step further. Check out Bulletproof HRV Sense. That stands for Heart Rate Variability Sense. Bulletproof HRV Sense goes a step beyond Food Sense, and it works with a wireless heart rate monitor that goes around your chest. You wear the heart rate monitor, and it'll talk to your iPhone or your tablet, and it'll show you your stress levels throughout the day. It'll help you know whether you're overtrained, overstressed, or even just help you know which meetings are causing the most stress in your nervous system so you can learn to take control of that stress. This is an awesome app. So number one, Bulletproof Food Sense is free. And number two, Bulletproof HRV Sense is a few dollars, and it makes a huge difference in how you manage and control your stress.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.